Hi, I'm Lisa Kennedy, and you're listening to The Bra and the Brave. This podcast celebrates the creative and the courageous. I am fascinated by those who are talented, forward-thinking, and inquisitive. Sharing their stories, wisdom, and everything in between, The Bra and the Brave is about people and their passions. So on to today's episode.
It's almost like you feel like you're jumping back in time when you hear that wee voice.
It takes you right back to
I know, totally. Oh, it's like triggering. But
I wonder the stocks. I wonder Zoom stocks, if they've gone up or gone down after COVID. That would be an interesting thing to see.
You're right enough, by the way. That's a shout. Totally. Here's us still hanging on for dear life. Like, we'll use the Zoom occasionally. I mean, it is good for these things because, yeah, you're a very busy human by the looks of things, so trying to pin you down and getting you to Bell Cell might have been quite a task. So, Andre Ajus, thank you so much for being here. I am aware of your work as a director and theatre maker, but I'm very excited to get into it. Because I actually know you through Creative Entrepreneurs Club, so I get to do a wee bit of stalking because I'm community manager. So I'm like, what's this interesting person up to? And you kindly reached out to say, let's have a chat on the podcast. I'm like, yeah. And this is what I love about this community is like people just reach out and want to be a part of it. And like, it's so humbling every time somebody asks or, you know, says, oh, I like the podcast or can I come on? I'm like, yes, like it's no question. So thank you so much for reaching out, Andre.
It's my pleasure.
I'm glad. And it's a Monday morning. We're kickstarting the week with some good chat, which I'll always enjoy. I mean, to get into it, like, you know, from the get-go, I'm just really interested in people's backstories in terms of like their introduction to the arts, theatre, dance, whatever it is their thing is. So for you, like in terms of theatre and making theatre, was that part of growing up for you?
Yes, I think theatre was always a really important part of growing up. I still remember the first time my grandfather took me to the theatre when I was seven, and he took me to the National Theatre of Malta, and we watched Kiss Me, Kate. And that was my very, very first show. And I still remember a conversation. I think I was seven maybe at the time, and I still remember a conversation where my grandma asked my grandfather, but why are you taking him to watch? Is it gonna actually kind of teach him anything? Is he gonna learn anything to go watch Kiss Me Kate? And my grandfather was like, no, he needs to go to the theater, he needs to experience the theater. So I'm very grateful I still remember that that event. And I think that, so I always grew up in the arts. I feel like my grandparents were very artistic people, and my parents as well really kind of supported me and were really encouraging. I started attending drama classes. It's almost like stagecoach from the age of four. So it was quite like, because what happened was we had a school production of Lion King. I don't know how my primary school got the rights to stage Lion King, but we won't go into that. And I was cast as Timon. And that was like, that was the very first, My mother and father were in the audience, and they both noted how comfortable I looked on stage. And my mum noted that during the song Hakuna Matata, I decided to take my completely unchoreographed. I took my tail and just started spinning it around. And so they agreed that there's a certain level of comfort being on stage. And that's where kind of my journey began. So I started first primarily training as an actor, and that's the foundation of my training. Mm-hmm. And then I kept on growing, and I kept on always kind of, I kept on attending these drama classes. And then I reached a point when I was 18 where I I had like my first debut as an actor, and that was in a play called Tender Napalm, and it's written by Philip Ridley, and that was my very first. I was 18 at the time, and it was myself and another. We were both very emerging actors, mm-hmm. and the producer gave us a chance, and it paid off because it felt like that was the beginning. And I genuinely thought that I would make a career as an actor. My original plan was always I would do a course at the University of Malta, mm-hmm. and then that would be like just as a because we know that this sector is sometimes has moments of flux.
Yes.
Something which made sense to me was that I would have something to fall back on. And so I started a degree in psychology, believe it or not, Lisa. So I was acting, but I started a degree in psychology. I spent a year and a half, and we got up to kind of the halfway mark in the year where we have like exams. Mm. And I remember I failed three of them.
Okay.
And I thought to myself, I said, what better sign that I'm not in the right place than failing these three exams? And so I decided to shift from a bachelor's in psychology, I shifted to a bachelor's in theater studies.
Mm.
And that kind of gave me, so I was still acting at the time, and I was doing theater studies, and it was a perfect amalgamation of those two, because it allowed me as an actor to really understand,
yes.
why we do things and why mm. we do them like this, and what how this all started. And it gave me a really clear idea. And it felt like both of them really went together. And then I did my dissertation. It was in characterization, how we create character through text. So when we have a piece of text, what is the text actually telling us? And the more I was writing my dissertation, apart from the fact that I was sure that I did not want to write another dissertation, I also realized how much I was really becoming interested in directing. And I always had a hunch that I wanted to direct at some point. But I think if I told 9-year-old or 13-year-old me that I'd be at this point back then, I don't think 13-year-old me would believe you. But I reached out right after I graduated. I reached out to a company who I had worked for as a director, as an actor, and I told them, listen, I'd really like to try my hand as a director. And that was the beginning. I was 20. I turned 30 this year, Lisa.
Wow.
So everything feels like I think I was either 21 or 23. That was when I started directing. And it's quite in Malta, usually kind of the idea sometimes is, it's changing now, but before, the idea of a director used to be they would usually be an actor, and then they'll become a veteran actor, and then they'll become a director.
Okay, so there's this kind of pathway.
Yeah, as a pathway. And so it was quite, I feel like my generation of artists have changed that, because now we're seeing more and more young directors come through. But at the time, it was quite a new thing that I was a young director in the room. And I was sure that I wanted to direct the way I used to enjoy being directed as an actor. And This was an approach that focused on playfulness and experimentation in the rehearsal room, and having people be very authentic and bring their own ideas and their own experiences, and then we understand how this makes sense. But I viewed the role, and I'm still very, very focused on that approach. And the thing is that I always saw the role of a director less as the person who has all the answers, and more a collaborator in the room.
Yes.
The person who asks the right questions.
Yes.
Or who puts the right element into the rehearsal room at the right time, or an impulse which changes something.
Of course.
So that's always been my view as a director. I've always said that I start rehearsals usually by saying that if I think I'm wrong, I'll be the first person to admit that actually I think I'm wrong on that one. Or
yeah, it's really important. I think that's a great place to start for any project, that you know you're not setting it up, that you have all the answers, or that you know exactly what you want. Because it is a process.
Yeah.
That's like half, if not like three quarters of the fun, is the making. So if you go in thinking like you've sussed it, or that you know exactly what you want, and there's no newness to find, there's no surprises. And that surely that's where the joy is, where you, the unknown, like what you're going to find in the room with the people in that moment.
Yeah. That's exactly how I feel. Because I think in my head as a director, I always know, I always say that it's not my production. It's not the writer's production. It's not the actor's production. It's our production. So all together, if the best idea comes, whether it comes from an actor, whether it comes from me, whether it comes from the person who is stocking coffee in the green room,
yes,
if the best idea works for the production, then that's what we're gonna try. Yeah.
and
we're gonna see if it's gonna, yeah, because essentially it's about creating the best possible work we can. And that's the fun of it. The thing is, in my head, I feel like when I direct, I'll have the picture of what I'd like to see. But then the fun of it is getting there, and then kind of discovering something along the way and experimenting with something and saying, oh, actually, maybe this could be like this rather than like that.
Yeah,
and,
of course. Yeah, it's good to have a starting place, something in your head that, you know, a goal or something that's inspired you. I mean, yeah, it's good to go in and not be maybe necessarily a total blank canvas, because, you know, you need something, a springboard, whether it's just a vision or whatever. But yeah, it's good to have that openness of just like, let's see what we find. And it is for the good of the show, like you say, it's not, no egos involved and stuff. What I'm interested in, I mean, there's so much in there, like the kind of formative years obviously are like so important, and it comes up in the podcast so much, like people saying, oh, when I was this age, I got to take to the theatre, or I was in a school play, and I just think it's so important. And I wonder, like turning 30, because I know it was quite recent, wasn't it? So happy birthday to you. I was going to say welcome to the club, but I'm out of that club. I'm away into the next one. but I wanted, like, because I celebrated like a big birthday a couple of years ago, looking back is quite a cathartic thing. I think when you are like that, those kind of milestone ages, like, oh, now I'm 30. Looking back, I guess, like, it is interesting to be like, where am I now in the journey? And for me, like, it's interesting because, you know, you obviously were brought up and raised and were studying in Malta, but you're now here in Scotland. So I'm interested in that journey. How did you end up here in Bonnie, Scotland?
Yeah. So that was an interesting journey. I feel like when I look back, there's always been links or moments that the more I've been living here, the more I'm just like, that's interesting. So for example, we can talk about formative moments. Mm. Like, one of the formative moments was the first show that I did. So the ones I mentioned, Tender Napalm, it did so well in Malta that we brought it over to the Edinburgh Fringe. So that was the very first time that I came to Edinburgh. I experienced the weather, the lovely weather during the festival when it's sunny in the morning and then pouring rain by the evening, and you're still in short, you're in shorts. So, and flip-flops. I still remember the first time I went to the Traverse, and I had that experience. And it was very interesting because that same summer I had gone to Rose Bruford, and I did a course there. And on Wednesdays we used to finish early on our course, and so that allowed us to get on a train from Sidcup and go straight to London and watch a play. And I remember we were all deciding what play to watch, and I wanted to watch Let the Right One In, which was the NTS production. And so it was interesting. I had a bit of a moment. I worked with Play Pie Pint last year, and there was an actor who was in Let the Right One In and was rehearsing in a room next door. And I still remember being at the stage door asking them for their signature. And now I'm in a rehearsal room right across from them. So it's like some,
Goodness.
there are some really interesting coincidences, I would say. I think my choice, I was very driven. So after I directed my first play in Malta, I directed for the National Theatre of Malta, and I directed Pinter for the National Theatre of Malta, and I directed Peer Gynt for the National Philharmonic Orchestra. I was feeling a bit like at the time I was an actor directing rather than a director directing. I was really relying on my experience as an actor. So I really felt like I wanted to go away and really understand and explore my craft as a director. And so I really looked at courses that allowed me to give me that time to just really understand my approach, understand my ideas, understand who I am as a person, but also understand who I am as a director. And so the Edinburgh Napier course, I was really drawn to that course. Because it was one of the only courses which was over 2 years. So it was a postgraduate over 2 years. And I thought it would be incredible because I'm not playing down the possibility of doing a postgraduate in 1 year, but I thought having 2 years is going to really allow me personally, that's what I thought. I thought 2 years would really allow me to really explore. And so I was also kind of drawn in. The course really focuses on dramaturgy as well. So it was over 2 years. I was going to get a really good understanding of dramaturgy, which is something I really wanted and something I really feel is essential for a director. Because I feel like dramaturgy is like popping the hood open of a car and then being able to say, oh, actually, that's why that is connected to that thing, because that thing is important for this thing. So I felt like having that experience as a director was going to be really, really important. And obviously, there are incredible lecturers who are working at Napier. There's Mark Thompson and Donna Sottomoretini as well, and May Sumbwayambe was also there. So it was fantastic because it felt like the right course at the right time, and it also. We were also a really small cohort. We were only five directors. So I thought that was going to be the perfect the perfect step in my development, because I thought it would really allow each and every one of us to have time to really understand who we are. And that's how I made my way to Scotland.
What I'm really impressed by is the commitment to your craft, because you were obviously already doing very well in Malta and you could have just carried on. Like you were saying, yeah, okay, you felt like a actor directing, but you were doing it. But that commitment, I'm just always impressed, because I went to uni once and I'd never do it again. I mean, I was just like, give me the bit of paper, bye. So I'm always impressed when people are like, yeah, I'm gonna keep my studies going, you know, and obviously you should always be learning, but like committing that time and that energy and really honing in on your craft kind of thing and your skills and upping that skill set.
Yeah.
And then obviously moving abroad, like moving from Malta to Scotland and making that commitment for those years. It's quite clear that obviously you had found the thing that you had to be doing and you were extremely good at.
Yeah.
So
I think the one of the things that really like governed my decision was the fact that I was sure that I wanted to do a practical postgraduate. So my undergrad was quite theoretical. There was a theoretical background, which I'm not, this isn't kind of, I'm not saying it in a negative light in any way, because I feel like it was so important for me, especially now that I'm a director, that I can look at periods in theater and understand what's happening and why this is happening. And also you start to see a bit of a trend where you're seeing, sometimes you see history, we say that history repeats itself, and it does. And it also, I feel like it also does in theater. So it really gave me the experience, but I was sure that for my postgraduate, I wanted to do a practical, practice-based degree, because I just wanted to really just have some time to just play around as a director. I feel like I got that, and I really had the time to explore my craft.
And in terms of like looking back at your time in Malta and directing and working as an actor and director, and then the opportunities you've had here in Scotland and just the way of working, how do they compare, or do they at all? Are they completely different? Like, what is the scene like in Malta in comparison? And I know obviously it was a while ago now, but is there a comparison to be made in terms of finding work as a director, working as an actor?
I think there is a comparison. I think when my girlfriend and I moved here, so we moved here in 20, I came to study for the first year in 2019, and then my girlfriend and I, we moved here in 2020. So
oh, wow.
That was like,
oh,
it was like, yeah. It was a bit of a crazy journey to arrive. But I was still midway through the course. So I was being asked to return and continue the course. The thing was that we did start to see quite kind of, we started to see parallels. We do see parallels in living in Scotland and living in Malta. And we see positives in about living in Scotland. And we also see positives in Malta. And we see, you know, you see the whole picture of both countries, and you're able to compare between the two. I think in terms of theatre, what I did notice is the language, the commitment to language, both in Scotland and the commitment to language in Malta, I feel like are quite similar. Also, in terms of language, what language do we hear in theatre? What is the language? What are the accents? What are the dialects that we're hearing in our theatre? Because Malta's language is a bit of a mishmash. What happened was Maltese was the working class language. And then while we were governed by the Italians, by the French. We were also governed by the British for some time, as you might see in The Crown. And the thing was, Maltese was a language which was always there, but was always spoken by the working class. And then what started happening was we started to pick words from other languages. So the word television, for example, there's a Maltese writing of the word television, but it's written in Maltese. So we started to pick these words, and it's a bit of an amalgamation. But what's interesting is different areas of Malta have different dialects or different accents. So I come from the sister island in Gozo, which is like the sister island to Malta. And there's, I think there are a number of different dialects. You go to a different village and you get a different dialect. And so I started to realize that tradition of language was something which was really interesting in comparing between both of them. And so, for example, Maltese wasn't because of during the time of the British brought over a number of and brought over their own theater. They brought the idea of playhouses, they brought the idea of pantos. So those remained in Malta, and they almost remained in theater. I think till a couple of years ago, theater was only performed in English. And then we would have Maltese plays, but it wasn't, I wouldn't say that the balance wasn't 50-50.
Yeah, yeah.
It was much likely that you'll see an English play more than a Maltese play. And then in the last couple of years, there's been a bit of a resurgence of Maltese works, Maltese playwrights, Maltese writing. And it really allowed kind of Maltese playwrights to really understand and tailor work more to Maltese society and to what's happening within the current kind of the current movements in Malta at the time. So I feel like in theatre, that's something that I saw as a common element.
Yes, interesting.
I think, yeah, it's really interesting. And the more like you sit down and think about it, the more, because our playwrights, so through history, our playwrights haven't been, you wouldn't, usually playwrights would have been, so for example, authors or poets, and then they would also write plays. So this gave us a very, if we look back in history, it gave us a lot of different, some of those works are still available to us. But this means that they weren't playwrights. And so then we started to see actual playwrights who didn't write books, didn't write poetry, but just wrote plays,
yeah,
start to come through. And that was when we started to see Maltese theatre really get up on its feet.
When you were working in Malta, were you working predominantly in English then? Exclusively in English?
I would say yes. So
that's interesting, because like, you know, your identity and your language at home, you're still you're working in English then to come over here to Scotland. And I wonder, have you had the opportunity? Is it something that you would explore, or have, you know, if you haven't already, in terms of working in your own language or working with a play that's been written by, you know, a Maltese playwright?
Yeah.
That's like fascinating. Like, you know, that
it is very fascinating.
You know, if you don't know what you don't know. So I didn't know that, you know, up until maybe more recently, that, you know, if you went to a play in Malta, it would be performed in English.
For example, the play that I directed for the National Theatre of Malta, that was called, in English, that was called The Hot House. Mm-hmm. It's a Pinter play called The Hot House, and we translated it to, the play in Maltese was called Is Serra. And Is Serra is the greenhouse. That's how it would translate. So sometimes you just have to, and that was all translated into Maltese.
Right. Okay. Right.
And I feel like the since I've been in Scotland, it's really made it clear how important language is and how important language and dialects and accents are when heard in theatre. And I think it's very important about the authentic, your own authentic accent, your own authentic dialect. I think is really, really important. I feel like ever since I've been here, I've been trying. I feel like I've re-looked at projects that I have in development in Malta. And I've said, what would that be like if we take that project and we turn it into Maltese? Mm-hmm. So for example, one of the projects which it's been in the pipeline for quite some time. So I pitched it back in summer of 2020. That's when I pitched it. We were deep in pandemic, and myself and an actor, we thought we wanted to keep the muscle up here going.
Yes.
Because lots of people were telling us to do yoga and to do stretches and go for a walk once
bake
a day.
Bake
banana bread and watch TikToks. But I feel like I was still doing my university course, so I still wanted to keep going. There was a Maltese actor who was in the UK and was not able to travel down because of borders that got closed. She's a good friend of mine, and we said, why don't we take a play and take a character in a play, and we just break it down. And we had no intention to pitch it. We had no intention to think about staging it. We just wanted to just keep our minds limber. And we looked at different, we agreed that we wanted a really strong female identifying character. We looked at Medea, we looked at Miss Julie, we looked at, you know, a number of plays. And then we settled on Nora from A Doll's House.
Wow.
We just started working through the text, and we both started to fall in love with the play, with the characters. And then it got to a point where I said, you know what, let me pitch it. Let me see if there's a particular theater in Malta. It's the National Theater. And I would say it's a similar theater to the Lyceum. That's the best way that I can explain it. So it's a similar theater to the Lyceum. It was built in the time of the Knights, and it is one of the oldest working theaters in Europe. And I pitched A Doll's House in the summer of 2020, and they were very interested in it. I wanted to do it in a very particular way. And then there was a change in artistic directors. So there you have to almost understand what if they're going to be interested in the project, if they'd like to move forward, or if they'd look at something else. Luckily, they were still very interested in doing A Doll's House. And I think it wasn't last summer, it was actually the beginning, so not this January, it was I think last January, uh-huh. Where I had a thought. I said, actually, how interesting would it be if it was performed in Maltese? And I was like, what if A Doll's House is performed in Maltese? And I think the main reason that I thought of that was because we're a Christian country, and the idea of marriage is still a sacrosanct thing, still a very important thing in our country, and the idea of that strong moment where Nora makes her final decision at the end of the play, I thought, how relevant would it be for an audience if they were able to hear the words that Nora's saying in Maltese. And I thought the strength in words of having someone say something in the mother tongue, I thought it was going to add a certain amount of relevance and a certain amount of strength, not only in the character and the play, but also in how the play is being received by the audience. Because I feel like as a director, you see a lot of directors who tell you, oh, actually, you shouldn't care what the audience thinks and the audience should just receive the work. But I think as a director, I go the opposite way. I'm a bit like, but the audience has to receive the work. So we have to keep in mind, how's the audience receiving this work? What are the audience? I mean, you can't think about everything. You can't think about what the audience is thinking or what they're feeling, but you can just have like strategically think about the play and just say, actually, when do I want my audience to think? When do I want my audience to breathe? When do I want my audience to just relax? It's, you know, we're asking audiences to sit through 2 hours, 2 hours and a half. That's quite a lot. That's quite a long, and it's not even like it's 2 hours and a half and it's, you're getting the whole story in 2 hours and a half.
Yes.
And I feel like we're in a time where in 30 seconds on TikTok, we get a full story.
Yeah.
So sometimes when a YouTube video is 15 minutes long, we suddenly go a bit like, oh, actually, this might be a bit too long for me to listen.
Attention spans are definitely shorter. We need those dopamine hits quicker. And we're not very patient. No,
exactly.
It takes a lot to grab our attention and hold it.
Exactly. And I think as a director, it's my responsibility. I can't speak for all directors, but it's my responsibility to just be like, okay, actually, it is inevitable that at some point audience members switch off during the production. So when do I want them to switch off? When do I want them, if they're going to switch off at the point when we're reaching the kind of the crux of the play, then they're going to leave and they're going to be a bit like, oh yeah, it was okay. It was all right. And I'm just like, but
it's not going to happen with my watch.
Yeah. So it's something that I really, really think about. I think about pace. I think about tempo a lot as a director. And there will be points where I'll ask actors to just be careful with how they're playing, for example, this particular scene or this particular page. Because if something important happened the page before and we've had the audience's attention and then we might get a dip in the next part, then we just need to be careful to just guide them and just, it's tricky. And this might not make sense, but I liken theatre directing to football coaching. Like, I think a football manager and the theatre director, I think they're not too dissimilar. The thing is, if a football coach, if the players on the pitch are scoring goals, the players will get all the fame. They'll get all the front pages.
Yeah.
All the glory. But if games are lost, who gets the blame?
So true. So true.
So I'm a bit like, the thing is, you cannot ask football players to run constantly for 90 minutes. There are moments in a play, in a football game where you ask footballers to run more than other times. So, for example, I still remember there was a Champions League final and there was a particular football coach who said, for the first 15 minutes, you cannot run at the ball. He said, for the first 15 minutes, you have to defend and you have to just keep strong as a team and keep hard. You have to move like, you cannot skip the halfway line. Everyone has to defend for the first 15 minutes. He said, after the first 15 minutes, then you all have to run at them. And what he did was he understood that the opposing team for the first 15 minutes constantly attacks. But yeah, after the first 15 minutes, they dip.
Yeah.
And that is the point.
Yeah.
To strike.
So it's strategic. Yeah.
So it's like, it is about being a, yeah, I think a director is like that. You have to create this strategy when you look at the play, and you have to just say, okay, actually, if I'm asking my audience, if something is happening and a lot of things are happening in the first 15 minutes, we cannot have things constantly happening for the next half an hour, because people will just dip and they won't remain focused, and they won't really be invested in what they're seeing.
Mm. So it's very much that kind of roller coaster ride, isn't it? Like the ebb and flow of it all, and like you were saying, like pace and just the nitty gritty of it, and look, the stuff that is important, the stuff that you agonize over, that you play with, that it isn't just a there's words in the page, say them, stand there, look there. There's so much to it, like to get it just right, just to get it that. And I guess it's just a feeling for you, because you're saying there is no rules, there are no rules. You don't go in with a set like this is what it's going to be like, but it's more like a gut feeling, like just you know when it's correct.
Yeah, and to almost, I like to set the tone. I like to set the tone very clearly. What is the tone of the play? So what are we doing? And I like that a lot, because at the beginning, that means that everyone starts from a very equal point and everyone knows where we are. So to go back to football analogy for a second, it's a bit like, a football coach, you know, the manager explains what type of football we're playing. This is going to be, one pass, like very, very fast football, like, and then we work the ball into the box. And then what this gives is that everyone's very clear of how we're playing, and you won't have someone who would randomly just whip the ball into the box because that's not part of the game plan. But also, if someone does whip the ball into the box, maybe that gives you like an idea. Mm-hmm. So it is, I think you said it so well. I think it is very much like a gut. It is a gut feeling, but there needs to be a strategy. And but then you have to be fluid enough to just look at the strategy and say, oh, actually, maybe we can do, maybe if this player plays better here, then maybe actually we need to give into that for a bit. And that's, I think, that's very similar to how I work with set designers, lighting designers, sound designers. I like them to go away and have their time and then come back with their own ideas. I like to start, everyone starts on the same level playing field, and then everyone just has their space to really express themselves. Because although I see the picture, I'm not a lighting designer and I'm not a sound designer. So I want someone to tell me, oh, actually, you know what? This piece of music would be perfect for this moment. And this is the importance. And this is why, to me, it is about people being quite authentic in the work that we're creating. And also, I'm missing a word, but the word, what is the word that I'm missing? It's like when people feel like this is their work.
Ownership.
That's the word. A level of ownership. So there's like a level of ownership that everyone feels about the work.
I remember hearing this analogy of, like, I can't remember who said it, and I feel really bad because I say it all the time and I'm like, who said it? But it was like someone was talking about basically a piece of work should have everyone's thumbprint on it. So every single person that's been remotely, and like you said earlier on, the person who's making the coffee in the green room or whatever, like everybody should have their thumbprint on that. And it should, you know, because all of those elements, however small or however big, make it what it is. You know, it's just like a fleeting moment, or someone just says something in passing, and that becomes integral to how something turns out. So I think, it's just like, and if they do have, and working with young people, I think it's important, like the ownership thing, because you can do a lot of like just talking at them and do this and stand there. And where's the learning? you know.
So I really believe, so I work with young people. So I directed for Edinburgh College. I have a good relationship with MGA Academy.
Oh, yeah.
I've worked with New Plan as well. I really believe that it's really important. I think it's really important to just listen and to understand and just work. Because the thing is, I make it very clear that I'm not a mind reader. So if someone is feeling something, I would much rather they speak it out and speak to me about it. Whether they don't, they might not feel comfortable speaking in front of the other cast members,
yes,
but there's always time to speak to someone individually. And I think that's so important because everyone, you know, we call this a play, and and a play, sometimes we need to remember that when it's a play, we are actually meant to be having fun.
It's not like rocket science, or like
it's not rocket science. Exactly. It's not rocket science. And it's not like, and the thing is, sometimes we just need to remember that we, I feel like we are so lucky that this is our job, that we get to play and to create this work and create art. And this is what I try to remind, especially actors who are still in training, that it is about them really expressing themselves and really being very clear in what they like and what they don't like. And if a scene is working, there have been moments where when I directed for Edinburgh College, there have been moments where they wouldn't be seeing what the final picture that I'm seeing in my head.
Trust me.
What's important is that common trust between both of us, that they, rather than having what was great was the group that I directed, there wasn't a point where they ever said no, or that's not what's working. They actually always threw themselves at the idea, and this mutual trust and mutual respect that I have your back and you have mine, I think that's so important to creating work that's so authentic and so so owned by the people who are making it.
Because you're going into a project, like, it doesn't matter how much experience you've got. I would argue, like, you're going into a project with the same trepidation, with the same, like, oh gosh, like, how's this going to turn out? Like, but we've all got it, like, and, you know, the imposter syndrome thing comes up a lot as well. And so it doesn't matter if you're working with young people, if it doesn't matter, you're working with the most experienced actors, it doesn't matter if you've had a million plays under your belt or this is your first play. I think we all go into it going, what's going to happen? What are we going to make? Like,
100%. 100%, Lisa. Honestly, you don't want to see me on the day, the night before of the first day of rehearsals, because I'll just be like, my girlfriend just gets most of the questions that, and I'll be like, oh, actually, do you think this looks good? What do you think about this? Does this make sense? And my girlfriend's like, you're overthinking this. Just go in and just be very clear, very honest.
Does she work in the arts? Is that her one?
Yes, she works in the arts as well. She's a book illustrator.
Okay.
So yeah, so our house is very much, the areas of the house that are like full of art supplies, and then another area of the house is like scripts.
Yes.
And then there's a midway where it's just books.
Love it. Yeah, it's the process is a funny old one, and like, I think to be a fly in the wall in rooms where, you know, at the start of the process, midway, and then just as something's just like, and it's kind of that moment where you're like, well, I guess there's always a deadline because it's going to go on a stage, it's going to go in front of an audience. You can't rehearse it forever. You can't keep mining forever. Like, you've got to make decisions and find a point where you're like, yeah, this is it. This is what we've made, whether we like it or not. Are you working on anything at the moment that's that you're finding is surprising you, that you've kind of came up against challenges? Or I'm just interested, like, because I mean, it's lovely, all the highlights and all the lovely things, but actually the moments of the sticky points are also nice moments too.
I think so. At the moment, I'm the associate director to Wills Wilson on Two Sisters, which is David Gregg's new play. And this was a we're in the last week of rehearsals, so
Oh,
this is
right,
live.
okay.
This is I'm coming live from the Lyceum, from the back rooms of the Lyceum,
It.
and it's been an incredible experience, because it's really given me and allowed me time to just really observe someone like Wills, and observe the whole process of, because as I said, I've directed main stage work, but I've never directed main stage work yet here in Scotland.
Yes.
I've directed for Play by Pint. I've directed at the Traverse, but there hasn't ever been like the scale of the Lyceum, if that makes sense. And so it's been great. I think the best part has been in seeing how, you mentioned early on, it takes a village, and it does take a village. When I sit in production meetings, it feels like there's like I liken it a bit. There's a scene in Pirates of the Caribbean where all the brethren come together, and it is a bit like production meetings are like everyone coming together, and everyone's really discussing and making it very clear. And I think what strikes me the most is that in that room, everyone is working to create the best possible work, and it's so important. It's been so important to just observe that process and see how all these things fit together,
Yeah,
and
that
how
jigsaw.
everyone, that jigsaw, especially on the scale of the Lyceum. That's, I think, something that really that's been, and as I said, I think I told this to a friend of mine, this week. I think if I told myself, my 13-year-old self, that at 30 years old I'll be an associate director to Wills Wilson on a David Gregg play at the Lyceum, I think I would tell myself, I think you're pulling my leg.
As you say in Scotland, you're havering.
So it's just been like, it's been,
Amazing.
it has
What an
been an
incredible
amazing.
journey. And like, God, you're so young still, like 30 is young, Andrea. I'm just telling you,
No, I
30
know
is
what
young.
you mean. I don't know if my sister, because my sister for the last 2 years has been constantly saying, oh, 1 year to 30. And I'm like, please don't, let's not
You're
have that
just a
conversation.
young pup. You're a young pup and achieving so much greatness
But
with all three.
you wouldn't believe this year when I turned 30, I was speaking, Janice Parker is doing, she's the movement director on Two
Yes.
Sisters, and we were having a conversation, and I was telling her, I apart from the fact that it was, it was incredible, I think it'll be incredible that I'll look back and say that is where I celebrated my 30th birthday. But I was telling her, I think 2 years ago I was really opposed to the idea of turning 30. I was very like, I'm turning, but I feel like this year, this is a weird thing. I don't know if it's a weird thing actually, but it's a bit like I feel like I'm at the right point. I feel like the I'm turning 30, and I feel like it's at the right point in my journey as I feel like as a human being, but also
Yeah.
as an artist. And yeah,
That's
it's
lovely.
a
That I
bit,
mean that's a great thing. Like celebrate that, like own that 100%. Because I think there's I mean, being in this industry, you'll know yourself like the uncertainty of it as well. Do you know what I mean? So like if you have moments of clarity or moments of like, do you know what? Like this is good. Like I think celebrate that and don't because oh I mean I've got a degree in overthinking and worrying. So like if you can like actually just I think because you're always thinking about the next thing, or is this going to be the last thing, or is it going to be good enough? All the questions, like we said, it's quite often that I'm just speaking personally, but you don't stop to just be like, this is great. Do you know what I mean? Like,
No, I
in this
know.
moment, this is good. And yeah, I feel like I'm where I need to be at this moment in time.
Yeah, I think it's very I think it's incredible that I'm working on this at the moment. But if we go back a few months ago, just a few months, not too long. So last May, I had one of the biggest burnouts I've ever had, because I feel like as a freelancer, you are, as you said, Lisa, there are moments where you're constantly like, okay, what's next? What do I need to be thinking? Who can I send this play to? Actually, maybe this play, if I send it to these two theaters, maybe they'll be interested in it and then they'll do a co-production, then I'll direct it. So it's because there were points where I would go to bed and I would just be like, actually, I need to email that person because that means I can get a meeting with them, and then maybe I can speak to them about this thing, and then maybe, and it was leading me to a point where it was just unsustainable. It was unsustainable on a human level.
Of course.
It
And
was
like, where
just
do you're pouring from an empty cup then,
you
you
are
know?
to, I was totally pouring from an empty cup, and it was incredibly, incredibly tough. And the thing is that I don't know if this is just me, but there are points where we take the lows really strongly, but we don't take the highs. We don't take the highs
So
as
true.
strongly.
So true.
And I promised myself, and that this year the main thing I would do is to look at the cup half full rather than the cup half empty,
Great.
because I feel like there were points which leading up to my burnout where it was about looking at the cup half empty rather than the cup half full. So as amazing as it sounds, I'm really trying to think about where I am today and what I'm doing today, and trying to do my best today, because I can't really tell what tomorrow's what coming up or what's happening tomorrow, or
Especially
and
plans, the universe has got its own plan.
yeah, the
You can
universe does
plan
have
to,
its own.
you can plan to a degree, and that's fine. Like, I mean, I'm a total planner, I love planning stuff. But then the universe just sweeps in, and then there's like, it's like that creative process. Like, if you don't leave anything to chance, or you don't leave anything like for any magic to enter, then it's just going to be a bit predictable and boring. Do you know what I mean? So, and okay, sometimes it's not magic, sometimes it's really crap and like really pants things happen. But do you know what I mean? Like, then you go, well, it was all meant, you know, like certainly like I feel in the last couple of years, like things have happened that, you know, I couldn't have predicted, or that feel like the worst thing ever. And then, you know, cut to like a year later, and you're like, do you know what? That's actually the best scenario, actually, that thing happened. But it's just, yeah, it's just been, present, like you say, I think, and grateful, and you know, aging is like a total privilege. Like, to get older, like we're talking about you turning 30, like all the experience you've had up to now, and like what's in front of you, like you take all that with you. Like, you're just putting more stuff in the backpack and taking it on to the next project, or you know, the next adventure. But are there like, so are you somebody who has quite clear ideas about the kind of work that you want to make, or are you just quite responsive in the moment to things that are happening, or things that you see or hear, and just kind of making them happen as they come to you?
I think I'm a bit of I think I'm I like to think that I'm a bit of both. I think the theater that I make, I'm very attracted to things that speak to things of relevance. I think theater that's relevant, theater that's urgent, and theater that really speaks speaks to people on a human level, I think that's something that I'm really interested. I'm really interested in messy, and I mean this like in a very total, like there's no connotations to it. Mm. I'm really interested in messy humans and seeing the messiness on stage and seeing the messiness of relationships, because I feel like life is messy and I feel like humans are messy. Yes. And we, you know, when you see something, so for example, the first play that I directed, it was called Skylight. It's written by David Hare, and it's about a relationship between two adults. They had an affair, and a couple of years, I think 5 years before, they had an affair, and then we meet them 5 years later. They haven't seen each other for 5 years, and then they suddenly see each other, and over the course of an evening they hash out 5 years that they've lost. So to me, that was really, really interesting. And it's plays like that that really speak to me. I love being reactive. I love being challenged. I feel like that's like, I love when, so for example, when I directed Pinter for the National Theatre of Malta, that one, I had no idea that was going to be the play. I had a meeting with them and they said, we'd love you to direct something for us. They spoke to me about three plays and they asked me to go away and have a think. And then once I came back, I was going to share my opinions, but they said, listen, we'd really like you to direct this Pinter. And it was interesting because it wasn't a play that I chose. It was a play that someone else chose for me, but thought that I would be the right person to work on it. And that really, really, it makes me really interested, because it makes me think that person must have seen something in the way that I direct or the way that I think, and said, actually, this play, let's bring Andre on, because he might bring something interesting or might bring something kind of. So for example, with A Doll's House, it is about relevance, it is about urgency, it is about speaking to the audience and making it clear what the play is about and what. And I love when people leave the theater and they just say, oh, actually, you know what I liked, what I didn't like. It's that discourse which is so important.
Yes.
I think that discourse is essentially what will keep theater alive and keep, more importantly, keep audiences coming to the theater. Because as much as I love going to the cinema and as much as I love watching Netflix, I feel like what I feel like makes us different from Netflix is the two things off the top of my head: the realness of seeing actors on stage be human. And I really say this to actors, I wouldn't want actors to get into a groove of how they do things and repeat the pattern over and over. I want actors to still feel that this is real and that things change and you have to react and be instinctive to what's happening. But I think the second thing is the fact that we sit in a dark room for 2 hours and then we walk into the bar and you see a friend of yours, and then you might meet at the pub and then you discuss the play and you're like, oh, actually, you know what I liked about the play and what I didn't like. And I feel like that's the main difference, where yes, both you and your pal, you could possibly watch a Netflix film and then meet and then discuss it. But just like the living the moment with someone, yeah. I still remember, you know, I go back to where this podcast started. I still remember when I was 7 and my grandfather took me to the theater. And that was something I still remember when, I think it was 3 or 4 months ago, I went with a friend of mine to the theater and we watched the play together, and then we went for a pint and then we discussed the play. So there's something, I think that's what keeps theater alive. It is the discourse and it is the realness of it.
Absolutely. There's nothing like it. And I think we should, and I'm sure people are so appreciative after obviously COVID, like, that we can be in rooms again and experience that. And yeah, I mean, I've spoke about this a lot in the podcast about the accessibility of theatre for people and just getting more people into theatre and making that feel that a space that is welcoming all. And like you were saying, the authenticity and accents and dialects and languages on stage, and feeling that you're represented on stage as well, like seeing you and your stories of all different types of people of all walks of life is important. That's where people feel that they are seen and heard, and that theatre is for them.
It is so important, and I think it is, we need to really think about audiences and just care for audiences. We need to feel lucky that they've come to the theater. We have to feel lucky that they've decided on this evening to spend this amount of money to
True.
come to the
Especially
theater.
nowadays, like money is, it's your hard-earned cash is hard to part with. So there's not a lot of extra doshing about. So if somebody's chosen to come and spend their time and not watch Netflix, get off the couch and spend their money to come and see it. Yes, I think like you said earlier on, like you do think about audiences and what how they're experiencing it. I think it would be foolish to ignore the fact that this is going to go in front of an audience and that how they're going to receive it, like you said. Andrew, this has just been like an absolute delight. Like I'm so chuffed. I'm just gutted we've not met in real life. I hope that we do at one point.
There'll be a chance. There'll be a
You're just
chance.
a busy human, but what I'm interested in is because we spoke about language, and this is called the Braw and the Brave. I do ask everyone what their favourite Scots word or phrase is, and having lived in Scotland for a good while now, I'm sure you've collected a fair few Scottish words or phrases. So, what's your favourite?
You know what I really do love? I do love that people say ta.
Ta a lot.
I love when people say ta. It's just like and at the beginning, when I moved here and people started using it, I wasn't sure about that. I was like, what are they for? It's grown on me so much because it's just like, it's such a quick way to just be like, thank you very much for everything. And it's just like, ta.
It's so funny because a lot of people teach their babies to say it before they say thanks. So they'll go, ta,
Ta.
ta. I don't think
And it's just like,
anybody's actually ever said that in the podcast. I think you might be the first person to say that.
good. But it's just like when people are getting off the bus and they go ta, and I'm just like, it's such an interesting thing. It's still interesting to me, and I still just like I smile at it when I hear it. But it's just like, I still
Love
remember
it.
my first reaction. I was like, what is it short? How is it being shortened to?
Is
And
there a
sometimes I.
Maltese like version? Is there a Maltese similar word that people would use to say thanks instead of thanks?
We just say it's a word that's called it goes grazie,
Grazie.
and it's probably that's like probably coming from the Italian
Italy,
grazie,
yeah, of course.
and so grazie is like,
Gracias in Spanish, isn't it?
and
Gracias.
gracias in Spanish,
Yeah.
exactly. I mean, it can be longer. We can say grazie hafna, which is thank you very much. But grazie is like the quick one.
Grazie.
Grazie, it's very, now just saying it is like Italian, like saying grazie.
Well, I'll say grazie to you because this has been an
So
absolute joy. I know how
it's been
busy you
a
are.
pleasure.
You're at this moment in the play and it's all going to be kicking off and I'm so excited for you. And I'll obviously share everything online. Now you're part of the clan, you see, Andre. So
Amazing.
everything you're doing from now on, please like just keep us posted and I'm excited to put this out in the world and let everyone know what you're up to. And I just wish you more continued success and I'm looking forward to seeing some of your work very soon, hopefully.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Lisa. Thank you for having me. It's been a
Not at
pleasure,
all.
honestly.
Welcome to the clan. You're part of the clan.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of The Braw and the Brave, a podcast about people and their passions. Join us next time for more insight and inspiration from my wonderful guests. Bye for now.